This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time now for sports. Which means time now for suits and boardrooms. NFL owners have approved a deal that would mean a start to the football season. The players haven't approved it yet. The head of the NCAA has said, quote, the integrity of collegiate athletics is seriously challenged. That little like saying he's shocked to find gambling in a casino. And here's Mike Pesca joins us. Mike, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Is there a football deal?
There is half a deal, or at least half the interested parties want there to be a deal. 31 of the 32 NFL teams, with the exception of the Oakland Raiders, who like to play difficult, have said, hey, here's our proposal. Why don't you guys sign it? And the other guys are the players who seem to be taking their sweet time looking it over. If you go by what the players are saying, which isn't a lot, and what the players are tweeting, which isn't a lot of substance, it does just seem that the players just wants a little bit of time to digest. I haven't heard from the players that we find this or that proposal objectionable. And what the deal does, if it does finally get approved, is it allocates the $9.3 billion the NFL makes in a way that's a little more slanted to the owners than it was under the last agreement. Under the last agreement, it was closer to 50-50. Now the players will get about 47 or 48% of the total revenue. In addition, the players are going to get some things that they want, including fewer strenuous workouts, those two-a-day workouts, which if, like me, you ever even played a little football, those were the things that you hated the most, getting up in the morning, taking a couple hours, and then showing back up in the afternoon. Those have been eradicated if this agreement gets signed. Retired players are also going to be getting about $1 billion, about $630 million in pensions, and retired players were worried how they were going to be handled under the deal. This is if the deal does indeed go through. We might have to wait a couple days to see if that happens.
Reducing workouts, though, is tied to the growing concern about the damage of concussion. And there was a suit filed this week by 75 former players who claim the league has assiduously concealed information about the dangers of concussions for decades, dating back to the 30s.
This is a theme that is going on in the NFL, and a lot of the things that the players asked for in negotiations, I think you wouldn't have seen so emphasized a dozen years ago. Things like limited on-field practice time, limited contact. Mm-hmm. And the head injury issue, the concussion issue, is one that has certainly come to the fore in the NFL. And I would just say that Roger Goodell had a choice a couple years ago. He could have obfuscated, he could have denied, dragged his feet, but Roger Goodell said, no, we're going to study the issue of concussions. We're going to acknowledge that it's been a problem. Well, the downside to that from the NFL's perspective is it does open you up to a suit like this. You very rarely see players anymore poo-pooing the effects of a head injury or saying, come on, I just got my bell rung. And when a player does say that, it becomes news just because it's so rare to have that opinion anymore.
Finally, Mike, the president of the NCAA, Mark Emmert, issued a press release this week saying that the integrity of collegiate athletics is under serious challenge today. He said a few new tweaks to the rules won't get the job done. Why is he speaking out now?
Well, in a couple weeks, there's going to be a conclave, a meeting where he calls together university presidents. And he, in advance of that, is saying this is not going to be some nibbling around the edges. We have to make some serious rule changes. Because during this, especially football offseason, we saw Jim Tressel being dismissed from Ohio State. We saw LSU being punished for recruiting violations, University of North Carolina. Issues raised in the biggest schools, the most prominent schools. The Journal of Higher Education did a study that showed that 53 of the 120 universities in the NCAA's top competition level, the Football Bowl subdivision, were found to have a major infraction in the last decade. It's just a terrible problem. But we don't know what Mark Emmert can do. He has said he doesn't want to pay players. That, for him, is a bridge too far. There is the fundamental problem of this billion-dollar industry. Just for basketball, CBS and Turner pays the NCAA $10.8 billion, and the main people generating that money, who are the players, they don't get any money. Mm-hmm. So this is there's no easy solution to that, but at least there seems to be an acknowledgement that we have to do a lot more in terms of enforcement. We don't just want to leave it up to investigative reporters to break all the stories that we have to follow up on. And maybe there's something we can do so that players don't feel that they're getting cheated out of money that's owed to them.
NPR's Mike Pesca, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You can think of this idea as Britain's Got Literary Talent. trio of writers in London have started an enterprise in which aspiring authors pitch an idea for a book. If enough readers say they'd like to read a book like that, the book gets published by a company called unbound.co.uk, which will split the profits with an author 50-50. Most publishers give an author just 10% of a cover price. To learn more, we've invited one of the founders of Unbound, John Mitchinson, to the studios of the BBC in London. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Mitchinson.
Delighted to be here.
So, how's this work?
For the launch of the site, we're working with established authors for the most part. And what we do is we go and film a short video with them, which could be an interview or a short animated film. Then there is an extract and then a written pitch as well, and some information on the author.
Who are some of the authors you're working with?
Probably the best known of the launch list is Terry Jones of Monty Python fame, who is writing a collection of stories called Evil Machines. The first story, which is on the website at the moment, is called The Truthful Phone, and it's about a telephone that instead of allowing you to hear the other person, it actually transmits what you're thinking about the other person at the end of the phone, with hilarious and actually slightly sinister consequences.
Are you at all worried that a book by Unbound will tell people, oh, you couldn't get another publisher?
No. All of the books that we had on our launch list could easily have been published through the traditional means. One of the novels in the first list is Amy Jenkins, and she has published two books, both of which I think attracted six-figure advances in the past. Each writer on the site has their own little private area that we call the writer's shed. And when you pledge to support a book, you get access to that shed. In there, Amy talks about how nice it is to have a place where she can interact with people who have already, as it were, voted with their feet, put their money where their mouths are, and joined and helped support her in her endeavour.
And when you mention people are willing to support, do they have to part with money when they essentially...
They do. It's a kind of an important thing for us, is that the way it works is you pledge against a book. We have a target, which we agree with the author. When we hit that target, the book is funded and can go ahead and be written. If it doesn't get funded, then everybody gets their money back in full.
How much support will somebody typically lend to a book?
The lowest, the reward for the lowest pledge, which is £10, let's say $15, $16, would be an e-book. And then that goes right up to £250, which is lunch with the author. And a couple of tickets to the launch party as well. And everything in between, you know, dedications, signed copies. We've got a goodie bag level where authors are choosing things that they think their readers might like. So it's just expanding the possibilities for interaction between readers and writers.
John Mitchinson of the online publisher Unbound at unbound.co.uk. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
The news that the Justice Department is preparing wide-ranging subpoenas in the News Corp case was first disclosed by The Wall Street Journal. It is, of course, owned by News Corp, and Rupert Murdoch considers it the jewel in his crown. The Journal has not been directly linked to any journalistic misconduct, but as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the scandal has raised questions about how the paper has changed under Murdoch's ownership.
From the moment Rupert Murdoch strode into the newsroom of The Wall Street Journal 3.5 years ago, he has cast an inescapable shadow.
Oh, I think all of us at the time the deal was announced were anxious about what it might mean.
That's Alan Murray, a deputy managing editor at The Wall Street Journal and the executive editor of the paper's online operations.
What News Corp's control of The Wall Street Journal would mean? Would it in any way affect the independence of the news department? Would we somehow be forced to carry some other corporate agenda that News Corp had? But none of that's happened.
But there have been some real changes. The Wall Street Journal's newsroom was moved from the Financial Center near Ground Zero to News Corp's headquarters in Midtown Manhattan. Murdoch and two handpicked editors from his Times of London decided to go head-to-head with the New York Times, which means it now publishes news sections about New York City life and leisure. That's been an investment of many millions. Sarah Ellison was a reporter at The Wall Street Journal for a decade who wrote a book about the paper's $5 billion takeover by News Corp. She said the new top editor, Robert Thompson, a trusted Murdoch lieutenant, brought a new metabolism.
He felt you needed to be hungry and you needed to be breaking news and you needed to be sort of in the trenches every day, aggressively pushing forward on whatever story it was that you were chasing. It's much more of a focus on breaking the story of the day.
There were gripping headlines, big photographs, shorter stories, all in an effort to draw in readers. More politics and international news, less, in her opinion, of the paper's vaunted watchdog coverage of corporations in Wall Street. And there are fewer of the elegant front page features beloved by writers and scorned by Murdoch. Alan Murray says the Journal has lost nothing and is gunning for new readers.
And when News Corp came in, they made a conscious decision to say, look, a lot of these papers are declining rapidly. I mean, they've become shadows of what they were in many of these urban markets. And yet there are people who still want to get a print newspaper delivered on their driveway every day. And if we expand our general news coverage, we can be that paper.
Murdoch's acquisition has irritated some investors. The Journal's now valued at half its purchase price. But circulation is up, and the company says the Journal has returned to profitability, though News Corp does not break down the figures. Back in 2007, New York Times columnist Joe Nocera was among those who actively endorsed the takeover, saying the media mogul's deep pockets would protect the paper. But now, in light of the scandal, Nocera has written a mea culpa. Here's what he wrote in a recent column, read here by one of the NPR players.
The Journal was turned into a propaganda vehicle for its owner's conservative views. That's half the definition of foxification. The other half is that Murdoch's media outlets must shill for his business interests. With the News of the World scandal, the Journal has now shown itself willing to do that, too.
Several former Journal staffers pointed me to news articles that referred to the assault on business by the Obama White House. But other current staffers, who spoke on condition they were not named, say such thumbprints are few, and fewer now than at first. Sarah Ellison says the new editors from the UK brought the Times of London's conservative take on the American media.
But they were correcting for what they perceived as a liberal bias. And so I think that that's something of a dangerous mission. And I think there are times when they overcorrected for that. There's no question.
More tellingly, Ellison says, the Journal has been slow off the mark in covering the scandal involving the News Corp tabloid News of the World. That's particularly notable because the Journal's publisher, Les Hinton, had to quit last week because he was the chief executive of News Corp's British newspaper group when the incidents are alleged to have occurred. He also gave testimony to Parliament that proved to be untrue. Hinton has denied knowing of any of the wrongdoing. Meanwhile, in a blistering editorial, the Journal blamed the scandal on the failure of police to investigate and its journalistic competitors for overhyping the story. Sarah Ellison says the paper has an opportunity.
And what I hope is that the Wall Street Journal can show through its reporting in its news pages that it really is still holding on to its DNA, that in a story like this, even when it's about their corporate parent, that they can really get to the bottom of it.
In recent days, the coverage has gotten appreciably more aggressive, including today's scoop. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Jake Marlowe is the man you'd want to sit next to at a dinner party. He's cultured, debonair, truly the most interesting man in the world. He savors fine literature, wines, food, and female companionship. He quotes Nabokov, Lawrence, and Starsky and Hutch. He tosses off quotable insights like, Wales is a stack of vowel-starved hills. Well, you can learn a lot about the finer things in life when you're 200 years old. And to add to his attractiveness, Jake Marlowe is an endangered species. He is the last werewolf in the world. The Last Werewolf is the title of Glenn Duncan's new best-selling novel. Mr. Duncan also wrote I, Lucifer, in which the title character isn't just a devil, but the man himself. Glenn Duncan joins us from member station KUSP in Santa Cruz, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And why are werewolves so seductive?
I mean, like all the myths that endure, they last because they express something very fundamental in the human psyche. Either a desire or a fear. In this case, I think both. It's the fear of the beast within all of us and the desire to be liberated into it.
Liberated into it in that we don't have to make any explanation for our feelings. They just overtake us and we act.
Yeah, there's something in that act of surrender to a really powerful drive that I think we're all very ambivalent about. You know, one of the reasons that natural history programs, animal documentaries are so popular, we love watching animals because they don't have this existential burden of choice. They just do what they do.
Yes, he thinks. He deliberates. He's even sensitive. But he he despairs because he says humans are moving into the demonstrative age. Help us understand that. Is that like people weeping on Dr. Phil?
From his perspective, having been around for 200 years and watched many of the sort of literary and psychological and therapeutic movements come and go, what he actually says is that, you know, if the analysand on the Manhattan couch opens his mouth and begins, "I feel," and then if he had any decency, would close his mouth again, because it's such an element of bankruptcy and self-deception involved in that kind of self-analysis. But at the same time, he's stuck with it. He is a reflective, intellectual, meditative, self-analytical character. So it's another aspect of the curse.
Why can't werewolves and vampires get along?
There's no answer to that, except it just seemed like the right thing to do. In my sort of scheme of things, they have a visceral antipathy. I mean, they actually can't bear the way each other smells. And it comes in very handy when you need to construct a novel with conflict and plot. So,
well, reviews have suggested that you finally give the werewolves their due over vampires, at least in the debonair sweepstakes.
Yeah, I mean, there is this collective idea of the vampire as elegant and the lovely clothes and the fine art and the sort of the ability to bring under their sway the nearest heaving bosom. So I think, you know, they've been objects of great envy. But the thing that's always struck me about vampires, mm-hmm. one is that they've got this absurd disability, which is that they have to sleep during the day. This just seems incredible to me that vampires, you know, that this is part of the mythology and somehow they manage. I mean, you know, basically all you've got to do is sneak up on one of them during the day.
Why didn't that occur to more people, of course?
You know, how are they managing?
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, is that, to my mind, vampires never seem to have sex. The bite was presented as a sexual surrogate act. That seems like no kind of fun at all. One of the things that seems absolutely clear to me about werewolves with their canine makeup is that they would be dogs, as it were.
Let me get you to read a section, if we could, where you describe what the impulses, the desires that overtake a werewolf in full flight.
Okay, here we go.
It's quite a stunning section.
"You don't just get the body, you get the life. Take a life into yourself. The deepest nourishment. Something like love. You'll see. The space between you swells with untenable potential. Her little breasts, the size of apples, and her thin-skinned throat with its pounding jugular, were already in my hands, between my teeth, taut and turgid, ripe for rupture. I stood outside. I saw how it would be. Nothing but my brother's grip on the rein kept me back. Not her. He let the thought stand alone, unembellished. Not her."
Ah! Ooh, pardon me. Let me fan myself a little bit after that.
Strong stuff this early in the morning.
Yeah, absolutely it is. But he's exhausted. I wasn't expecting that, yeah.
You know, I always proceed in writing a novel on exactly the same principle, whether it's about a werewolf or whether it's about a middle-aged housewife in Lincolnshire. Try and imagine what it would be like to be in that person's situation. So, granted, this is a pretty bizarre situation. You know, it's a creature with a potential 400-year lifespan, who every month, in order to stay alive, has to kill and eat a human being. Now, of course, that's a larger-than-life moral predicament. But once you take seriously the idea that he's not going to kill himself, I mean, those are the options. You either kill yourself or mm-hmm. you reconcile yourself somehow to what you have to do. Once you take that situation seriously, it becomes potentially a novel of genuine moral inquiry, which was the real appeal.
And help us understand what makes Jake so tired. I mean, he has been around 200 years.
He's been around 200 years, and he's read everything. that's pretty exhausting.
Yeah.
It's difficult to answer that fully without giving away a plot point, but basically he has forbidden himself to fall in love. That is the kind of deal that he makes with the universe in recompense for the atrocities he has to commit. And the reason that when the novel opens, he's ready for death is because that's what he can't take anymore, wandering the world without love.
I suppose I have to ask, have you heard from any werewolves since this book has come out?
What I've been surprised about, I suppose, so far is that I haven't had any letters of complaints from self-appointed werewolf experts. I'm interested that you haven't asked this question, actually, because the question that almost every other interviewer has asked so far is, did you do a lot of research? And
I'm capable of asking all kinds of silly questions, but that one didn't occur to me, yeah.
Kind of stumped by that. You know, the answer that I want to give is to say, yes, I did 6 months at the Institute of Werewolf Studies in Alaska, and, you know, I have a diploma in lycanthropy, but sadly no such place exists, and there was no research for this book. It was just a case of consulting my own imagination.
Glenn Duncan, his new novel, The Last Werewolf. Well, Mr. Duncan, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This week, it's wilting heat, but recent months have brought us other weather extremes.
The Souris River is cresting today in the flood-battered town of Minot, North Dakota.
I've never seen so many storms come through our state at one time.
Let's go next to Texas, which is suffering from a drought. And the word drought doesn't really capture it.
Climate scientists have predicted that global warming will cause more extreme weather events. Has the future arrived? We've called Dr. Martin Herling, who's a meteorologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Dr. Herling, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Hot out there. You've heard?
I have felt it.
How certain are you that global warming is a contributing factor?
If we look at the planet as a whole, the whole average of all months of the year, we can say with great confidence that the warming of the climate system is pretty much unequivocal. And that's based on observations. The temperature has risen. It's risen beyond what you would expect from chance. When we start looking at smaller scales, so tornadoes, for instance, or the flooding rains in the Ohio Valley, there the science has a great challenge in front of it, and that is to understand how climate change would manifest itself either in sign or in magnitude at those small scales.
As I don't have to tell you, Dr. Herling, there are people who wonder, how can you talk about global warming when we had what was called Snowmageddon last year?
Mm. Well, you know, I'm going to take us back a little bit. While the heat wave and drought have been going on in the south central U.S., it has been very wet and very cool, if not cold, in the Pacific Northwest. And so that contrast, it makes it very confusing to speak about global warming. On the one hand, how can both be happening of opposite signs in such close proximity? And here the story is probably less about global warming in terms of that pattern than it is about another climate phenomena that has been in place for hundreds of years, perhaps thousands of years, as far as one can tell from the data, and that is called La Nina.
Mm. And does global warming affect this?
Yes, absolutely. When you ask the question, does global warming, the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, affect weather systems? Yes, the answer would be it does. How does it affect it is the question that we're challenged with. That's where the research challenge is right now. Rather than an event such as the heat wave, I'm going to point to something that's more longer in its time scale and bring it into the current, and that's the Arctic sea ice. As we speak, the latest update, which came from the National Snow and Ice Data Center located here in Boulder, indicates that the sea ice extent in the Arctic as of the middle of July was at its historical low, breaking the record that was set in 2007. And temperatures near the pole are running between 11 and 14 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal. Now, no one probably complains about that if you're at the pole, but it's the canary in the coal mine. In the Arctic, we're really looking at climate change, and we're looking at very significant impacts of the changing chemistry of our atmosphere.
Help us understand, Dr. Herling, how someone living in southern Illinois or Missouri, which seems an awful long way, which is an awful long way from the polar ice cap, how might they be affected by the melting of the melting that's going on in the Arctic?
In many ways, it's useful to think about this heat wave that we're having. If we can go back to the heat wave, let's think about that. Not necessarily worry about exactly the cause in this instant, but let's think about this as to what will climate look like in about 50 to 100 years in that region, southern Illinois. The experiments that are used to project climate into the future are indicating that an event, a heat wave of, let's say, 1 in 100 year recurrence in the 20th century type of frequency, would happen perhaps once every 10 years, maybe once every 5 years. Conditions that are so uncomfortable today, the reason that you're talking to me about this today is people are uncomfortable. If we're not adapted to the situation that we're experiencing today, we almost certainly will not be adapted to the temperature conditions that are on the horizon as we go deeper into the 21st century. So it's a good wake-up call for us as to what climate may become as we continue to increase our emissions of carbon dioxide.
So what your suggestion is, instead of just putting up with this for a week or two, this might become summer.
The extremes that we're experiencing today may become the normals of the latter half of the 21st century.
Dr. Martin Herling specializes in climate dynamics at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks so much.
Thank you.